Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. My guest for this episode is Dan Kittredge from the Bionutrient Food Association, which is a nonprofit organization that has a threefold mission about raising awareness of nutritious, nutrient-dense food, which is accomplished by educating growers about how to build their soil and produce more nutritious foods and the benefits to do so, to educate consumers on nutrition and the benefits of nutrient-dense food, and also to produce a consumer-grade device that can be used to measure which product among a certain class of foods is the most nutritious for us. That you could go into a grocery store at your farmer's market, select a bag of carrots, and scan it and see whether or not that is what you would want to buy. And our conversation about that scanner and how that would work got my analytic geek mind kind of turning over about it. So we spent a bit more time talking about that device than I might have otherwise. But part of building that device is also to make sure that the use of that device and the information on nutrition is backed up through empirical science and firm research showing that foods grown under these methods are more nutritious, that the consumer is getting more from these products than they might otherwise, and also that this device measures what it's supposed to. If this is your first time hearing about nutrient-dense foods or the idea of nutrient-dense farming, I recently did an interview with Mary Johnson that started this conversation and gave an overview of the idea of nutrient-dense farming and how we can build our soils to produce better food. So you may want to go back and start there. And I'll include a link to where you can find that in the show notes. Or if you're on iTunes or another podcast application, you'll find it by browsing through the archives. It's only a couple episodes back. So why don't you kick your feet up, relax, join Dan and I for this conversation, and I'll be back with you afterwards with some more thoughts and information on this. Now on to the interview.
If you could give us a little bit about your background, I would like to begin there so listeners have an idea of where you're coming from, and then we'll begin talking about the Bionutrient Food Association and nutrient-dense food.
I grew up on an organic farm in central Massachusetts, and my parents run an organic farming organization called NOFA. I've got a strong background in the organic world, both from an educational standpoint and from a practical standpoint. I've spent time on small farms in Siberia and India, in Central America, you know, around this country. I've spent a good amount of time learning from farmers around the world. And I've basically been a professional organic farmer most of my life. For the past 4 years, I've been also paid to run the Bionutrient Food Association, which is an organization I've helped establish in a process that started with working as executive director of Remineralize the Earth. I basically have a pretty strong background in hands-on process of growing food. I'm not a PhD, I'm not a agronomist per se. I'm more of a sort of a common sense farm boy type.
And out of that practical experience as an organic farmer led you to Remineralize the Earth and now the Bionutrient Food Association as a way to improve the quality of the food that farmers are producing?
Well, it was for a number of reasons, but the central one was that when I got married almost 8 years ago, I was forced to deal with the central fact that I was unable to make a good living to care for our family, to provide for our family. I was working effectively part-time at low wage, managing my parents' farm, and I didn't see many models out for people functionally farming and making a good, reasonable income and having a decent quality of life. It seemed like most of the farmers I knew either had nothing and worked all the time or worked all the time and had a little bit. But as far as a basic quality of life, farming didn't seem to be cutting it. Just looking at the sort of organic farmers in my neck of the woods in New England, most of them had to have a second job or they had their spouse has had another job. But as far as being able to make a living off the land in a reasonable number of hours per week, it didn't seem to be happening very much. So that was sort of a reality check. And the second component was that I got to thinking about organic, and I'd always sort of assumed that organic was better. You know, I was brought up with that understanding, or sort of implied understanding. And I got to thinking about the fact that, in my experience, we had pests and diseases on most of our crops every year. And in most cases, our crops were killed by the pests and diseases. And I just sort of started to think about, if organic is better, then why are our plants so sick? If organic was better, then presumably our plants would be healthier, and so healthy, in fact, they would be resistant to pests and diseases, because it does happen sometimes, just not most of the time. You know, those two sort of thoughts got me going, and I was reading a book called Secret Life of Plants by Peter Hopkins and Christopher Bird, and at the end of the book it said, for more information, to contact Remineralize the Earth, and gave the address of the organization in Northampton, Massachusetts. I was very intrigued. I was aiming to learn more, to figure out how I could do a better job and be a better grower, and a lot of the insights in that book seemed quite pertinent, so I proceeded to go and talk to Remineralize the Earth, and actually was offered a job helping to run the organization, my background and my interest. So that's really where it started. And as I began to experiment more with remineralization, with various stone dust, basaltic stone dust, local volcanic stone dust from out west, etc., and see dramatic results with the crops and the farm, I thought, there's something to this, and let me delve more deeply into it and see if I can attempt to understand more, and for my own purposes as a farmer, and then potentially for the purposes of agriculture in general and the farmers around. It's been a gradual process of working to understand biological systems, and understand limiting factors, and share those insights with people. But it's really stemmed from a practical desire to grow healthy plants and be able to make an honest living off the land without having to work all day every day.
It sounds like the work that you're doing right now is a full-time job. Is it, or are you still able to farm?
My wife and I have a 15-acre homestead, and we probably manage about 15 or 20 hours a week during the growing season on the farm, and then the rest of the time is spent running the organization. So there's a number of full-time jobs in the organization that aren't getting done. So it's a question of, we do get done what we can and wait till later to get done the rest. We've got a fairly large mission and endeavor with the organization. Our formal mission is to increase quality in the food supply, and it's quite ambitious, obviously. And our strategy for doing that is effectively threefold. One is to work with growers and helping them to understand biological systems, helping them to understand limiting factors in their operations, and effectively giving them support in growing healthier, more productive, better tasting, higher nutrient level crops. And working with all modes, A, being out in the hinterlands, giving workshops and courses, web-based YouTubes and research papers, linkages between farmers, profile pages effectively where people can begin to find each other. And then piece two is working with the consuming public and raising awareness about the correlation between flavor and nutrition, about nutrition and health, about mineral deficiencies and degenerative diseases, you know, all the different degenerative diseases that we've got in fairly epidemic levels in our culture today, whether diabetes or heart disease or cancer or the autism spectrum, bipolar disorder, all the sort of effectively systemic dysfunctions that we've got going on in our bodies as a populace, and the correlations to mineralogical deficiency in our food supplies, and explaining how, you know, we need enzymes to replicate DNA, and, you know, we get 4 billion new cells in our body every day, and every single strand of DNA needs 56 different minerals at the core of enzymes to be replicated, just to sort of really lay out the basics and help people understand in a common sense way how the food that they're eating is affecting their health and the health of their families. And then finally, the real sort of empirical hard science research to come up with simple tools that can be used in real time to discern qualities. effectively giving Jane Housewife the ability to go to the grocery store and choose the most flavorful bag of carrots off the shelf, go to the farmer's market and be able to determine before purchase which farm is doing the best job with nutrition and is growing the most flavorful produce. So we can have an economic driver that can push implementation of this process. Step three, and that's our bionutrient meter. The technological capacity exists right now to have a little portable handheld near-infrared spectrometer. It looks like a little flashlight or pointer. And you point it at a carrot, press the button, you get a flash of light like a camera flash, and it'll spit out on a digital display, you know, what's in that carrot. So our objective is to do the research on hundreds of samples of each of a number of different crops so that we've got a database with algorithms where in that flash of light, the chip can determine the relative quality of this carrot in relation to others that we've tested in the past and give the consumer that information before they choose which bag to pick up. Not just consumers, but buyers, wholesalers, farmers, anybody can do this. But to actually have an empirical capacity to discern quality and to inject that into the marketplace is our final objective strategically, with the understanding that the ability to go to the grocery store or to the farmer's market and test quality is potentially embarrassing for a number of individuals and organizations. And with our capacity to communicate in real time that we have now with the internet and all the social media, et cetera, it becomes most attractive and most inspiring for companies like Whole Foods to, in fact, begin to use quality as a metric in their purchasing. For example, has been said to me by a regional buyer for Whole Foods, was when you guys have this meter 2 years from being ready to go at the, you know, consumer price point, tell us, and we will give our growers the word that they have 2 years to meet standard or we'll stop buying from them. So functionally, train the farmers how to do a better job, educate the consumers about the importance of high-quality food, and then inject a transparent, empirical monitoring into the food supply so that we can give the consuming public the ability to make their purchasing decisions based on quality, not on label or aesthetic or any other random metric. That's functionally what we're up to with the organization. It's certainly a large endeavor, but it's proceeding forward nicely.
The most interesting part of this, to me, is hearing that in conversations with Whole Foods, that you'd be able to leverage with them to get this testing into markets where consumers would be able to see it in such a way then that you can use market forces to make this a national standard.
Okay, so a couple of misunderstandings there. There's absolutely no labeling, and we're not talking about a certification process or anything like it. What we're talking about is Jane Housewife has a little gizmo, it looks like a little pointer or a little flashlight in her purse that she pulls out when she goes to the grocery store, and she can point and shoot, flash the light at a bunch of carrots, and it'll go, boop, crap, boop, crap, boop, decent, and she can choose a decent bag of carrots in real time based on what's in those carrots right now and choose accordingly, or at the farmer's market, or when she's deciding which CSA to join for her family. The technology exists, the capacity exists. All we're missing is the data sets that can give us very, very strong confidence that our meter is going to be predicting correctly every time. We have to do lots of research in correlating mineral levels and spectral signatures and compound levels and all these things. I mean, what is quality? What is nutrition? It's this massive amorphous hole at the center of the food movement, from my perspective. We've got the organic people, we've got the biodynamic people, we've got the local people, we've got the permaculturalists, we've got all these different slow fooders, you know, Weston Price people, we've got all these different streams in the food movement, and everyone is really, I mean, they're really talking about quality, but they don't have the data to back it up. Local is supposed to be better because it tastes better, picked more fresh, but plenty of local crops are of quite poor quality. Organic is supposed to be better because it has less toxic chemicals in it, but from a nutritional standpoint, it may or may not be superior to what you can buy conventionally. There's a a lot of farmers, and this is something I can say as a farmer, you know, are doing a fairly poor job of growing crops. And the direct correlation between that, you know, the health of those plants and the health of our bodies and our psyches and our emotions and our spiritual capacities, I would suggest. If you want to understand the physics of vibration and structure and coherence, what you put into your body has a lot to do with your perception of reality. I would suggest, from a deeper strategic standpoint, if we want to have a powerfully positive effect on our culture, that getting good food into people's bodies is a really systemic way of doing that. Not to mention the implications of for global warming, of sequestering carbon that's going to happen if you have a functioning biological system, etc. So, yeah, we've gotten sidetracked from the topic of the bionutrient meter and how it works.
No, that answers my question more clearly then, because when you were talking about whole foods, the way that I took that was that they were going to be using those meters for their growers in order to leverage that into their grocery stores. And I guess that there would be a desire for that on the part of growers. So then as this information spreads and the meter becomes more available, the producers and the markets that are selling that food don't want to have consumers coming in and rejecting it.
Right. The way the conversation went with Whole Foods was, if you can give us a reasonable amount of warning, like a year and a half, 2 years, from when consumers will be able to have these machines and take them to the grocery store and actually test for themselves how good our produce is versus Stop and Shop or Safeway or, you know, whatever the other competing Trader Joe's markets are. When people actually can test, they want to make sure that they have better produce. And right now, that's an open question. And so they understand the significance of this and the implications of it. So effectively what they said was, if you give us enough time, we will tell our growers that we won't buy from them anymore if they don't meet basic standards. And this isn't really a hard job. I mean, it's really not that hard to do a decent job growing high quality produce. In fact, from my perspective as a farmer, it's more economically advantageous as a farmer because my cost of production goes down, my yield goes up. When my plants are healthier, I lose fewer to pests, I lose fewer to disease, they have more energy, they are more productive, and all I'm doing is amending the soil with various rocks and seawater, effectively. So my input costs will go down, my yields go up, my loss to pests and disease goes down. It becomes more reasonable for me to be an economically viable farmer growing healthy plants. So the incentive structures are really interesting in this whole subject, where it happens to be good for CO2 in the atmosphere to grow healthy plants because you sequester more. It happens to be good for the subsoil and the aquifers and the dead zone to grow healthy plants because you're not leaching any chemical fertilizers. You don't need chemical fertilizers. You're not leaching all the pesticides and the herbicides and the fungicides. It happens to be good for the farmer because you're more economically functional, more economically stable, more profitable on growing healthy plants because your cost of production goes down. And we can go through, you know, the whole supply chain and talk about it's in the interest of the consumer because your children are more likely to eat their salad because their carrots taste sweet. You're more likely to be systemically healthy and have fewer issues with degenerative diseases, have more energy, be more vital, be more vigorous, be more intelligent, more curious. You know, anybody in the middle of the supply chain, restaurants, health food stores, grocery stores, wholesalers, all those guys have the capacity to discern quality and be able to provide for their customer, you know, a superior product, which is going to give them that economic advantage. So, I mean, from my perspective, it's a real interesting little alignment of enlightened self-interest. And it all can be put into place and really stimulated with that real research on what is quality, what is nutrition, which is not in anybody's individual profit-minded self-interest, not for them to do it. So we're taking on this project as a nonprofit educational organization and trying to develop relationships with other organizations and individuals who see the value in order to raise the money to do the research. And that's where we stand right now on that project. But we're certainly actively doing workshops and courses around the region, around the country, to growers and consumers already and building our website out.
So right now you're in the process of raising awareness, educating people on it and how they can begin looking for more nutritious food and then using that to develop your handheld meter and the research necessary to correlate between that meter and nutrition?
Functionally, yes. We're basically working on educating growers. Our major project is educating growers in best practices in biological systems, in sort of a comprehensive year-round, what do you do, when, and why? How do you use the most natural, inexpensive materials to do it? And then we're also working with consumers talking about flavor, nutrition, health, etc. I mean, really, our major focus is with the farmers and helping them understand biological systems.
When you're looking at focusing on nutrients in foods, how are you determining what a nutritious food is? I feel like that question's almost rather vague and a bit nebulous because of everything as you point to or can be derived as what nutrition is. But is it that you're trying to grow, like, for example, the carrots that you mentioned, the sweetest carrot with the highest concentration of particular minerals and vitamins in it that you can, and using that as like the paragon carrot of what people should focus on trying to grow? Or is there some other breakdown when trying to determine what a nutritious food is?
That's a very good question. My understanding is that it is they're called phytoalexins, they're called antioxidants, they're called phytonutrients, the secondary plant metabolites, which are in many cases the aromatics, the flavonoids, the compounds that give a crop, that give a food flavor and aroma, are the sort of the pinnacle of nutritious compounds in a plant. And we've coined the term bionutrients as, you know, they're biologically derived nutrients. So if you look back into food science, you know, in the past couple of generations, there was a big revolution when they understood that, you know, this is what vitamin C is, this is what vitamin D is, and we need magnesium, and we need calcium, and a lot of companies started to synthesize these compounds and put inorganic or unavailable minerals or compounds into their foods. And so you could say vitamin D added or calcium fortified. And functionally, from a biological perspective, these additives are, in many cases, they come in one end and go out the other, or they're not recognized by our body as what they're supposed to be because they're synthesized, not naturally manufactured. But there's been a whole conversation about, we just need these basic minerals, and so we'll add them to our otherwise poor quality crops or foodstuffs, and thereby provide our bodies stuff that we need. And that was going along in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And really, as we've gotten more sophisticated in our research and our understanding and our technology, it seems to be that the essential oils, the phytonutrients, the antioxidants, those things which make an onion taste like an onion, make a blueberry taste like a blueberry, make a carrot taste like a carrot, those are the compounds that have the systemic health-giving attributes to animals, which is what we are. So I use an example, you know, I mean, there's numerous examples, but you've got tomato A you pick out of your garden in August, and you know what that tastes like, and tomato B you picked out of the grocery store shelf in January, and you know what that tastes like. There's a profound difference in flavor, in aroma, and, you know, if you're sensitive in you know, how it affects your body between those two tomatoes. And they may be even the same variety, but they have systemically different mineral levels, which correlate with the lower order compounds like the vitamins levels, which correlate with the protein levels, correlate with the lipid levels, and finally correlate with the secondary plant metabolites. So what we're looking for is really plants that have high concentrations of those secondary metabolites and the whole structure. I mean, as I understand it, the way a plant works is it starts out with photosynthesis and makes sugar. And then with those sugars, it makes carbohydrates. And with those carbohydrates, it makes proteins. And with the proteins, it makes lipids. And with the lipids, it makes the secondary metabolites, the antioxidants, etc. And as you move up each step in that chain, the plant needs greater levels of and broader levels of different minerals, form the core of the enzymes to build all these higher order compounds. And so what we're looking for is a plant that's got this full spectrum of minerals and compounds in it. And what we can find with our near-infrared spectrometer is we can functionally, because every mineral has a vibratory frequency or a spectral signature, you can flash a light and have bounced back the levels and ratios of minerals and compounds in that crop in real time. And so we're trying to correlate different levels and ratios of minerals and compounds with the presence of those higher order phytoalexins, which are difficult to perceive directly through the near-infrared spectrometer, but they correlate nicely with certain levels and ratios of the minerals and compounds that are present in larger numbers. Is that too complicated of an answer?
No, I'm going to see if I understand this correctly then. With using the near-infrared spectrometer, you're trying to develop a fingerprint for various crops so that you can determine whether or not they are, as you said earlier, you know, crap, okay, good, great. But that the way that you're doing that is because you can't necessarily get a reading on these trace compounds of the antioxidants and the phytonutrients and whatnot.
Not with a machine that can be manufactured at a consumer price point.
Of course, because we can measure just about anything we want to in a lab with enough money and enough equipment. But in order to make something that is useful to the consumer, you're looking for a fingerprint that corresponds to the macronutrients of the carbohydrates, fats, and proteins for a particular plant, combined with the secondary or micronutrients that would be our vitamins and minerals, which would then give us an idea if those are in high proportions.
And good ratio. Level and ratio are both important.
And then if those are in both good levels and ratios, then you can say with fair confidence that those tertiary trace nutrients are going to be present in that plant as well, which then you can say, this is something that's nutritious, this is something that you want to eat, put into your body, and feed to your family.
Or, from a realistic standpoint, the carrots in this bag from this company are relatively better than the carrots in this bag from this company, which is what it comes down to in real life. This one is 3 out of 10, this one's a 5 out of 10. It's only 5 out of 10, but it's certainly better than 3.
And right now, where you're at is getting the money and resources together so you can send off a bag of carrots to a lab where they can send you the nutrient profile, and you can correlate that with a reading from the near-infrared spectrometer to get you an initial fingerprint, and then work on growing better carrots, and then testing those better carrots to see what its signature is.
We've got a lot of the pieces in place. We've got the labs that we're working with. We've got the other nonprofits that are interested in supporting us. We've got growers and consultants from around the country. So the real issue is we sent in a bunch of samples in 6 weeks ago, and to test one carrot, to do a mineral assay cost $35. To do a carotenoid assay was $100. To do a phenolics assay was $50. And to prepare that sample was $89. So we're looking at, you know, $250 plus to test one carrot. And when we do that and we can build a large enough data set, the information becomes quite interesting and clear. But the issue is having the cash and to run those samples and build a data set. And that's simply a question of time and money. And so I was at a conference this past week in Kentucky where I was talking to various organizations and companies about what we're up to and working, as I have been for a number of years, to build some sort of a groundswell of support amongst people who know better. And that's proceeding. But we're talking about lots of cash, and we're not talking, and there's no immediate upside. It's not like a venture capitalist is coming here and say, here's $3 million, guarantee me 10 in 2 years. This is really a project that is for the greater good and can have a significant effect on a number of underlying issues, but not devised as a profit-making scheme. So, or at least for one individual entity. So it's taking more time than it could if we're just trying to make money doing it.
Because of that limitation with time and money, do you have a focus on particular crops that you would like to develop these signatures for first, that you could get this handheld meter to market sooner by narrowing the focus, or do you want to have a fairly broad base to pull from before you try to move in that direction?
I mean, I think we need to do our proof of concept. We're starting with carrots and tomatoes are the crops I was sending to the lab this fall. If we could get 10 crops well done, and we could program the meter, it's really data. So there's no reason that we can't upload. Once you've got your meter, we couldn't send out a software upload that would add new crops to the capacity. It's simply a question of getting that initial ball rolling. We're talking about millions of dollars any way you look at it. And we are a young, classic, underfunded, ambitious nonprofit. So millions of dollars is just not in our scope right now. For me, it's a question of talking to the biodynamic people, talking to the organic researchers, making connections with health insurance companies. There's some really interesting alliances that begin to show up here. There's labs out there that actually do this kind of work. There's companies that manufacture these machines, and everybody's got a little bit of an interest in seeing this work. So the question is, can we devise a program where we can get some of the bigger organizations to get significant grant money? We can work with a lab that's already a USDA lab to get some money funded there. If you can put together a proposal that's got industry support, that's got, you know, nonprofit support, that's got university support, then you're much more likely to get those kind of big grant awards in the millions of dollars that would be necessary for funding this kind of thing. So it's more of a political conciliation and relationship building and inspiration process right now of getting the critical people, organizations on board and getting them to work together in saying this is a priority. I don't think we're going to be able to do it by ourselves. It's a coalition, I think, it'll have to be.
Well, to any of the listeners who hears this interview, if you're in any of these industries and have some pull that you can help Dan move this project forward, let me know. We can get in touch and see what we can do about getting this ball further down the hill. I have a background in information technology and computer science. That's where I was before I got involved in food and permaculture and all these other things. So when you start talking technology and software and machines, it's very easy to capture my interest and go in that direction for a while. Let me move us away from that little point where my brain's trying to analyze and pick apart the issue at hand and get back to the current world of nutritional food and permaculture and the work that you're doing. If someone out there is a grower, we talked about remineralizing soils with rock dusts. You touched on that earlier. Where could someone who's a grower begin to find out more information about that, or organizations that they might partner with, or just some basic rock dusts that you would recommend someone add to their soils to help remineralize it?
I was surprised we spent so much time on that topic of the biometric meter. Usually my interviews are much more hands-on conversations. So it depends entirely on your individual soil and where it's at and what it needs before, you know, I can make any intelligent suggestion. It's one of the catch-22s. In general, I will say, if you have a deposit of basaltic type rock or perhaps a granitic type rock in your region, oftentimes we have quarries where the stuff is dug up and crushed to be used for roads, be used to build buildings, etc. If you have a deposit, a local quarry in your 5 to 30 or 50 mile radius, it's a material that oftentimes has a broad spectrum of 15 to 50 minerals in it, and it's finely ground. The byproduct is, they call it fines, and it's oftentimes just dumped back into the hole that they quarry the material out of because the particle size is too small and it has no economic value. So for $2 a ton or $4 a ton or $6 a ton, you can get a broad spectrum mineral amendment sourced locally for your operation. That is, in general, that is the core of remineralization. And for people who are curious, remineralize.org is a good website and a good organization that's been working on this topic for 25 years. When I say rock dust and seawater, I'm talking about limestone. I'm talking about, on top of this basalt and the granite and other sort of local stone materials, I'm talking about limestone, gypsum, rock phosphate, green sand. We have at the core of a lot of organic and sustainable ag practices the process of adding rocks to our soil. We just don't necessarily call it that. If you want to get into the geomorphology of your soil and your soil type, you can look into the subsoil. You can really do a really quite sophisticated assay of what is present in your soil and what is not, then match that up with local deposits. And that's something I'm working on here in the Northeast, is working with a very skilled prospector and overlaying the GIS maps and the soil type maps and the quarry maps to hopefully by springtime we'll have the Northeast U.S. mapped. And we can say, here's your general soil type. Here's what is not in the soil in your region, in this valley, or in this county, or in this whole state. These are the minerals that are just not present, and here is a local deposit of material that contains them. You can systemically address underlying deficiencies with local raw materials that are effectively byproducts of industry right now. And there are other companies that are working, taking really high-value rock dusts and grinding them up into very small particle sizes and turning them into foliar sprays and nutrient trenches you can water into your soil. I mean, there's a number of different ways you can do this. There's lots of consultants that support farmers. We've been working as a nonprofit to educate farmers in basic biological principles so they can understand the issues themselves and make intelligent decisions themselves and not be at the whim of consultants who are trying to sell them something. It's a fairly nuanced conversation, and in reality, every operation is unique. So there's different ways of discerning what you need and what you have. But if you don't treat your soil like it's an individual organism, I think you're going to be missing the point.
This isn't about a wholesale blanket solution for every location. It's a tool to be used to build the unique soil for the area that you're in.
I see it as a living system, as your soil is alive, ideally, or necessarily, your soil is alive. And all we're trying to do is identify what can be done to increase the life in your soil. So another way of saying that is, what are the limiting factors that are inhibiting the vitality of the life in my soil? And every situation is unique. Every soil is different, as we all are different. You know, individual organisms, humans, we're all different. Every garden, every field is different. And the more you can understand what's going on and what that soil needs and provide it, the more life will be profound in the results you receive. It's a living system, and if we simply can provide life what she needs, we can basically stand back and do very little and have plants that grow vigorously without pests and diseases, producing lots of crops that are really quite amazingly flavorful. It's a very gratifying process. You must minimize tillage. Every time you shred that topsoil, you destroy trillions of organisms. I've likened it to genocide in the past without, you know, the human connotations necessarily, but we're functionally, every time you till the soil, you're creating a genocide in the soil. That's absolutely anathema to high-functioning biological systems. And there's all sorts of little things that we do because we always have or because we think we're supposed to that are destructive to the soil. And when we understand those things and stop doing the destructive things and identify what's holding life back, which in many cases is something as simple as water. You know, if you don't have enough water in the soil, then the whole system slows down and then shuts down. It's really basic. The basic minerals, the basic air, water, minerals, carbon, and biology, bacteria and fungi primarily. And in many cases, we don't have the biology. So, you know, inoculating your seed when you plant it is a extremely inexpensive, very powerful thing to do. So there's all these little tricks that you can do to stimulate and support the biological system. And functionally, when you do that, your plants grow better. And that's where we're at right now is working the grassroots angle and saying, you know, if you're a farmer that gets this, and you understand that your plants are sick and they shouldn't be, then here are some basic processes that you can engage in. And don't take our word for it as an organization. Try it and see what your results are. And that's basically how we've been growing, is by saying, here's the basic information. You know, we're not trying to sell you something. Take it or leave it. If you think it's intriguing, try it and see what the results are. And people come back and say, wow, I live in a whole new world now. This is what I've seen happen in my field this year was it just transformed my whole understanding of what's possible. And then it's like a drug. You want more. You want to do it better and more every year. It's a very gratifying process.
From the grower moving to the consumer, what can consumers do if they want to be looking for more nutritious food now?
Well, we have the sense of smell and the sense of taste, and our nose and our tongue are actually extremely sophisticated sensory organs, and they were designed to help us discern quality. So say you're at a farmer's market and you've got 10 farms to choose from. Pick up the tomatoes and smell them. Pick up the carrots and smell them. Pick up the cucumbers. Literally, if a crop has more aroma, it's better for you. Those aromatic compounds are the flavonoids that have the altered trace elements that are critical for your DNA replication, etc. when you're actually in the supermarket, you're actually in the farmer's market, using your senses of smell, and you're not supposed to eat things before you buy them, so you can't use taste, but smell works certainly well. So that's a really powerful way of doing it. What we're trying to do with our organization is build a network of profiles of farmers. So if you join the organization as a farmer, you get a page on our website saying who you are, what you do as far as a fertility program is concerned, and you are doing the best you can to grow high quality crops and basically create an alternate reality where people are working on this topic and self-organizing around this topic and making it possible for consumers to find produce that they can feel confident is superior. So it's a generally, you know, local stuff is better. Generally, you've got farmers in your area, and it's a, more of a process of elimination. Now, go and spend a little bit of time, buy a bunch of carrots from 8 different farms, and taste them all, and see which one tastes better. And the next day, or next week, buy a tomato from 8 different farms and taste them all. And use that. Talk to your farmers, talk to your friends, you know, mothers in school, talk to the PTA, wherever you want, sort of begin to have this conversation, raise awareness, share the information with the farmers you buy from. If you join us, if you are a member of a CSA, if there's 2 or 3 or 5 different CSAs in the region, go out of your way to talk to farmers and see, you know, who may be already doing this and who is totally resistant. At least here in the Northeast U.S., we're starting to make some decent forays into the food movement. I mean, a lot of people are talking about nutrient density, a lot of people talking about quality, a lot of people talking about bricks. It's certainly much more than was happening 5 years ago. I haven't spent enough time in other parts of the country or other parts of the world recently to be able to say where things stand there now, but it's basically down to basic common sense. What we are doing as part of our organization is a local chapter leader strategy, which is similar to what the Weston Price Foundation does, where people who hear about this, who are excited about it, who want to see it happen, can effectively contact us and say, I'd like to start a local chapter here in Blairsville, Georgia, or wherever you are. So we can send you literature, pamphlets, information. If you want to set up a lecture, I can come down, somebody else can come down and speak. If you want to put together a course for farmers, we've got a 2-day course that really walks growers through the entire biological system in the growing season and really gives them a lot of tools to begin to improve their productive quality. So, I mean, we're basically, it's a grassroots model right now, but people need to take some proactive responsibility. It's not like you can look for a label and everything's going to be there for you.
Around here, there's a large push for farmers markets and CSAs. I was at a recent meeting, and they were some of the farmers who were there were listing all of the CSAs that deliver into the local city, and they rattled off probably a dozen different CSAs that were there. We have numerous farmers markets, and I know many of our farmers, if they have something that you're interested in, you have the, in many cases, the option if you want to taste something. Maybe they'll have a sample melon open or something like that. So there's opportunity for consumers to try before they buy and get involved and get to know the people who they're buying their food from and begin to ask these questions and become engaged.
That's really where it's at right now. I mean, the word, the concept, the information is starting to percolate through the food movement channels. We can be very happy that we've got so many CSAs and so many farmers markets around these days, because certainly there weren't in the 80s and the 90s anywhere near this kind of access to local food. So if you've got 10 or 12 CSAs to choose from, you know, spend a little bit of time and call up each one and ask them some probing questions, and you'll find out in very short order what their mentality is and their conceptual framework and practices on nutrition. It's a competitive advantage for them if they have consumers that'll be committed to them if they do a better job. And that's really where it's at. And as I talked to farmers about seed and the really deplorable state of the seed supply in this country right now, we really just, as farmers, the seed we have access to is, in most cases, bottom of the barrel. And what I tell them is, call up your seed companies and let them know that you know how bad their seed is, because they know, and they don't tell you. When they've got the seed size, they've got the test weight. In many cases, if a carrot, the optimum test seed size won't go through a 12 screen, what you're being sold will go through a 6 screen. It's half as big as it could be or should be for great vitality. And if we, as farmers, start hassling our seed companies and say, hey guys, we know what you're up to, we will buy from whoever has the best quality. The same thing should be done with the consumers. Start hassling your farmers and saying, hey, we know what you're up to, and we will buy from you if you provide superior quality. So it's that grassroots political activism kind of impetus, I think, is where power still resides.
And certainly, as you mentioned earlier, with all of this on-demand information that we have available to us between the internet and smartphones and all the connectivity that's currently available, it's easy to share this information, get it out there, and be able to take action with it.
Right.
If anybody else wants to find out more information about Dan and the Bionutrient Food Association, they can go to bionutrient.org, and I'll include links to that in the show notes. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
Well, I think it comes down to this question of quality of life. And it keeps coming back to, and this is something that I feel like I've been able to dramatically increase my experience of life, my energy, my vitality, my creativity through the food that I eat. And I think it's one of those things that's so simple and so central. You know, they say you are what you eat. And in most cases, most people are not really doing a good job building themselves a healthy body. And most people don't have the energy they'd like to have, are weak, they have some imbalance or disorder or another. Most people are on pharmaceuticals of some sort, if not multiple. And I think, if I can continue in my grand generalizations, most people sort of are, they just basically accepted that fact, that they don't have the vitality they'd like to have, but something they can do about it. And it seems to me that, you know, the real impetus for change comes about with parents and their children. I feel like, and my experience has been, you know, I didn't care too much about myself until I had kids. And then all of a sudden my expectations and my priorities shifted and I felt obliged to do as well as I possibly could. So if not for you, but for your children, if not for you, but for your spouse, we really have the capacity to build ourselves much more vigorous bodies, to reverse degenerative diseases, to increase our emotional balance, our hormonal balance, our spiritual attunement. I mean, I think we really can live quite fulfilling lives, but for the fact that we don't have a basic biological organism that's functional, it's never going to happen. So the opportunities are significant, and that really inspires me. And a lot of other people who get this and are working on it, you can feel the effect in your body. You can see it. You can see your friends getting younger. It's quite exciting when you get into it.
Well, thank you for that message of inspiration. I'm sure that it will help to carry many others onward down this road, as the idea of nutrient-dense food is important to my listeners. I got quite a lot of feedback about continuing on this idea and this topic, and I thank you for being a part of this conversation as one of the people at the forefront making a difference, sitting down and spending this time with me so that I can share it with the world.
Thank you.
And that was the second of this now ongoing series about nutrient-dense food and nutrient-dense farming. I like the conversation with Dan because of how this information and really all of the work that we're doing within permaculture and trying to build a more resilient world that can support permanent culture and permanent human civilization, the way that it all interconnects, that by seeking to build our soil with these rock dusts and other fertility methods that don't leach in the same way, we reduce the amount of runoff into our waterways that might occur by using more fast-acting fertilizers. From the conversation recently with Connor Stedman, we can look at ways to store carbon in the soil using these methods by building more productive plants, larger plants with wider ranging root systems that get more carbon into the ground and into the plants themselves, which we can then use other methods for long-term storage of that carbon. It's about community building and education by going out and working with farmers, learning from them and sharing with them these methods, which then goes back to holistic management and whole farm planning and how we can transform modern agriculture and teach people all of these different ways that they themselves can make a difference in their own lives, in the lives of their families, so that they can take the prime directive of permaculture to be responsible for ourselves and our descendants. And in that process, through that, if I'm getting this right from what Dan said, that selfish personal interest, change the world in a very positive and dynamic way. And the guests who will be joining me in the next several episodes will be helping to add to that body of knowledge. The first of those is Chris Shine, who will be joining me to discuss his forthcoming book, A Vegetable Gardener's Guide to Permaculture, which, for those of us who are in the know with permaculture, I think will be useful for giving to our friends and neighbors as gifts, but also adding that information into our own toolkit to have different ways to present permaculture to our community. And after that will be Bonnie Preston, who at the moment I'll call a food activist that my wife met at the recent Pennsylvania Women in Agriculture Network Woman to Woman Conference. And Bonnie was there to speak about how you can bring about transformational change within your own community by working within the system to change the laws and ordinances for the better, which is one of those key hurdles that we are going to have to work with to implement many of these resilient and sustainable practices, so that what we want to do isn't illegal and becomes a regular part of our communities and the society at large. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.